military and intelligence agencies, as well as to armed forces in the United Kingdom and other Western countries. Palantir's current chairman and one of its co-founders is Peter Thiel, a technology billionaire who also co-founded PayPal and backed Donald Trump's winning US presidential campaign in 2016. Earlier this month, Palantir reported quarterly earnings of $558 million and said it expected its annual earnings for 2023 to exceed $2.2 billion. In comments to investors, Karp claimed the company was building products for a world that is violent, disjointed, irrational, a world in which you have to show strength, a world in which you really have to pick sides. The National Health Service previously used Palantir's software to manage data during the COVID-19 pandemic, but its involvement in the British healthcare system has been opposed by privacy campaigners. They have called on the British government to end Palantir's involvement in the National Health Service, citing the company's involvement in developing mass surveillance equipment for the National Security Agency, NSA, in the USA, and for the GCHQ, government headquarters in UK. In 2017, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported that Palantir was one of two technology companies providing predictive systems used for intelligence at Israeli security organizations that the newspaper linked to the arrest of scores of Palestinians based on profiling of their social media activity. Continuing Israeli attacks on hospitals and medical facilities in Gaza have been widely condemned. On Monday, 20th of November, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the head of the World Health Organization, WHO, said he was appalled by an assault by Israeli military on the Indonesian hospital in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, in which at least 12 people, including patients, had died. The head of the WHO, the World Health Organization, Ghebreyesus, said health workers and civilians should never have been exposed to such horror, especially while inside the hospital. Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières, said a Médecins Sans Frontières clinic in Gaza City had also come under fire. On Saturday, 18th of November, up to 7,000 people inside Gaza City's Al-Shifa Hospital, including premature babies, critically ill patients, displaced families and medical staff, were given just 1 hour to leave the hospital by the Israeli military. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Recently, thousands of England's National Health Service doctors signed an open letter calling on the British government to condemn Israel's attacks on Gaza Strip. Earlier this month, hundreds of health workers protested outside the Department of Health and Social Care to condemn the British government's support for the Israeli regime. A spokesperson for Health Workers for a Free Palestine said, Palantir has come out in full support of Israel's bombardment of Gaza, received funding from the CIA, and helped the National Security Agency, the NSA, with their worldwide surveillance program and worked on artificial intelligence for US military drones. The spokesperson added, businesses that trade in death should have no place in our healthcare system. Palantir did not respond to a request for comment. The Department of Health and Social Care did not answer Middle East Eye's questions about UK health workers' concerns regarding Palantir's support for the Zionist regime. Instead, a spokesperson sent a statement addressing data privacy concerns. The statement claimed, patients' data has and always will remain under the full control and protection of the National Health Service, the NHS, and it will not be accessed by the company that makes the software. Also, National Health Service England did not respond to Middle East Eye's request for comment about Palantir's support for Israel. It claimed, NHS England is conducting a fair and transparent procurement process for a supplier of the Federated Data Platform in line with public contracts regulations, and this process has not yet concluded. Amnesty International said Palantir's involvement in serious human rights abuses meant that NHS England should have rejected the bid. The company has come under fire for helping the US Immigration Enforcement Agency, ICE, implement a tough deportation policy that Donald Trump introduced in 2017. Its technology helped enable ICE to identify, exchange information about and track migrants and asylum seekers, and also to plan raids that led to parents being arrested, separated from their children, and deported, Open Democracy reported. Palantir has also supplied technology to governments that allows them to spy on their own citizens.
Start. Movement. Speak. Living Hope.
Tour the Pit.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaikum. You are listening to Youth Station on IRB English Radio. And in the studio today, I have Brother Hassanain here.
Salaamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
How are you, Brother Hassanain?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm good. So today, Brother Hassanain, we're going to talk about the different effects of Islam that you can see in the life. It doesn't necessarily have to be the life of people living in the West.
Right.
There's anyone in general.
Mm-hmm.
The different practices and structures that are embodied within our lifestyle from Islam.
So, Islam and our lifestyle.
Yes.
Well, I have a point over here to mention. I believe that Islam is not in our lifestyle. It should be vice versa. Our lifestyle should be Islamic.
Okay.
First of all, if we look at Islam, what's Islam? Islam is a religion. It's a deen, right? It's a way of living life as per Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay, so what you're saying is you have to live your life within these parameters.
Exactly.
And a religion sets those parameters for you.
Exactly.
Okay.
Because Allah has sent us and He had made the perfect religion for us, Islam. So, you know, there's nothing like, you know, non-Islamic lifestyle. Like either you follow Islam, you're within the parameters, mm-hmm. or you're out of it, or you cross the boundaries.
Okay.
Like if you're Muslim, there's nothing like Islamic lifestyle, non-Islamic lifestyle.
Uh-huh.
If you talk about non-Islamic...
Oh, so you can't split it up as, okay, look, one day I'm going to be Islamic and the other day
exactly,
I'm not.
Right? Like, if you say that,
okay,
I'm living non-Islamic lifestyle, there's nothing like non-Islamic lifestyle. We call it in Sharia, haram.
Mm.
It's Islamic lifestyle, like, within the parameters, within the boundaries that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has set for us.
Uh-huh.
So deen, as I said, is a way of living life.
So where can someone find these parameters, per se?
We believe that, you know, these parameters are a set of religious values, right? These are the beliefs, norms, thoughts, and different, you know, patterns which are formed based on Quranic and Ahlul Bayt teachings.
Okay.
You get it from Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam and Quran.
Within the Quran and within the sayings and the
right.
teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, you find these parameters. They've
right.
set them. So now suppose someone who's living in the West,
right?
right they're not in that Islamic background. So
uh-huh.
I'm talking about a Muslim who's living yeah. in an area
right.
that isn't Islamic,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't have, suppose, say in the East, say in the Middle East, suppose.
Right.
You're in a country where they recite the Adhan,
uh-huh.
right? For every prayer.
Yeah.
So you know it's, okay, it's the time for prayer, right?
Right.
They have places for you to do wudu or ablution
mm-hmm.
before you pray.
Right.
But like in the West, how does someone find those parameters and stick to those parameters in the West, where it's an area where they're going against Islam, right? In
mm-hmm.
some cases, they're completely trying to rid that area of Islam. It's not just getting to know the parameters, but it's, look, understanding what they are and living by those parameters. It's two different things,
uh-huh.
right?
Yeah.
So you said you could get
like
the parameters through Quran and the sayings of the Ahlul Bayt,
right?
Right. How does someone live through that in an area that's completely against Islam?
What does he have to do with the area he's living in?
Say it's an area where it's preventing him to live his life through those parameters. What is he supposed to do? When Muslims, right, when we are born, there are different customs that we have. Suppose when a child is born, the adhan and the iqamat are read in their ears.
Right.
Right? There is, suppose, a sacrifice given of an animal.
Right.
And you bring in other believers to celebrate the auspicious occasion of the birth of a child.
Right.
Right? Okay, Brother Hassanin, I have more examples, but let's take a short break and then we'll come back to continue this.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So, welcome back. I have Brother Hassanain here with me in the studio, and we were talking about the parameters of Islam and specifically how one can live their life through these parameters in an area that might be against Islam.
Right. So we are discussing about Islamic parameters, right? So we said that Islamic parameters are the norms that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has set for us. So as mentioned before, we can find these norms from Quran and the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. So if we say, like, you know, what are the boundaries, if we talk about, you can say that, you know, the halal and haram are the boundaries. Like in Sharia, you get five different things, like halal, haram, wajib, mustahab, and mubah. So these are the parameters. If you are living, if you're observing these, if you're abiding by these norms, you're basically living an Islamic lifestyle. You're not going against the laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you're going against the laws, you're crossing the boundaries. And your lifestyle is shifting from the Islamic lifestyle.
So you got to have that Islamic point of view while you're living
exactly. Your life. You know, the performing of the wajibah, like praying salah, that's Islamic lifestyle. You're doing something mubah. You're still following the Islamic lifestyle. It's nothing out of Islam.
Can you explain mubah to our listeners who might not know what it means?
Neither wajib nor haram.
So it's not a compulsory act, but it's also not something that can be held against you.
Exactly. Like, you know, just sitting idle, you know, raising your hand. You know, it's not. You have
just typical actions.
Exactly. Okay. That's mubah. So, you know, if you're abiding by these laws or the norms, you're following an Islamic lifestyle. You ask me, where can we see Islam in our lifestyle?
Yeah.
So, you know, apart from these, if you want to pick out something where you can say this is Islamic, you know, point out something.
For example, suppose I want to live in an Islamic lifestyle, but where I'm living isn't allowing me to do that. What do I do in that situation? For example, in France,
they've banned hijab,
right? One's covering.
Uh-huh.
Now, when a child becomes baligh, right, they reach that age of maturity.
Right.
Again, the age differs for boys and girls. For girls, it's typically 9 years old.
Yeah.
And for boys, it can be anywhere from 13 to 15.
15, yeah.
Right? Now, for a girl, the second she reaches this age of maturity, she has to cover herself.
Right.
From those who she isn't related to some extent, right?
Right.
Where it's her immediate family, her parents, her siblings, you know, that's fine. She doesn't have to cover herself there. But suppose strangers, to the extent even cousins are considered strangers.
Non-mahram.
Exactly, non-mahram. I was just trying to explain the concept of mahram and non-mahram to our listeners who didn't know what those two words meant. Right? So now, again, we will continue with these two phrases, right? So mahram are those, suppose, those individuals who are in your immediate family that you don't need to cover from.
Right.
Non-mahram are strangers. To the extent even your cousins are considered non-mahram. Where, look, you have to cover yourself.
Yeah, but my cousin is not stranger to me.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's strangers, and to the extent even cousins are included in this group of non-mahram Right? So now suppose, for example, this girl wants to, you know, live according to the Islamic parameters.
Right.
Right? She lives, suppose, in France, where they've passed a law that anyone under the age of 18 can't wear a headscarf, right? But now it's compulsory on her to wear a headscarf after the age of 9.
Right.
And in some instances, they say for them to practice this concept of wearing a headscarf, you start a couple years earlier, right? So they get accustomed to that way of dressing, right? They're used to it. It's not something just brand new sprung upon them, right? She's trying to live by those guidelines, but the area she lives in is preventing her to do that.
Yeah, for this, I guess we need to ask our maraja, our scholars, what do they say about this? Because, you know, I don't really want to say anything because I'm not expert in this issue. Over here, we need to ask our maraja, what do they suggest, like someone living in France? Okay, you know, you might say that, okay, those women, they shouldn't leave their houses. But that's not possible, right? If someone has to go to school.
Exactly.
So we need to ask
our... stay at home all day?
Yeah. We need to ask our maraja.
Okay.
So apart from this, when you're talking about, you know, where can we find Islam in our lifestyle, all these things are there, halal, wajib, haram. If we leave these things aside, in a small things, we can find Islam. When a baby is born, what do? You recite adhan in his ears. You take ghusl and you pray, taking wudu. You know, these are the things where even non-Muslims can find
so
Islam in your life.
It's not something far-fetched. It's not something completely out of the bounds of like typical living.
Right.
So you're saying over here that I can live within those parameters with people who aren't Muslims or who don't have the Islamic point of view per se in their life.
Yeah.
It's not just only Muslims who pray. We have Christians who pray.
Yeah.
We have Jews who pray. We have different other sects and different other religions that pray.
Right.
Right? So me praying shouldn't be that much of an obstacle living in an area, suppose like the West, against Islam.
Obstacle to whom?
To those who are living there.
In what sense will you be an
obstacle? As in, suppose you're living in a country that's against Islam.
Uh-huh.
They don't want Islam to spread within their country
to
such an extent, right? Yeah. So they will try to minimize any Islamic push.
Activity.
Exactly. Whether it be an activity, whether it be demonstrations, whether it be, in a sense, opening the public's eyes to the real, true Islam that the Prophet brought. Right? Not the, you know, this is our version of Islam and this is all you need to know. Right? The true Islam.
Yeah.
Living within the parameters of Islam, having this point of view of Islam, does that only benefit us or does it have an effect on the society as well?
We following the Islamic lifestyle, you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course it has a good effect on others, right? If you're really following the Islamic lifestyle, if you're really following the parameters, and if we're really abiding ourselves to the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam. Ahlul Bayt, if you study about them, what was the position of Ahlul Bayt in this world? They had the position of wilayat, which is above everything. They had everything.
Can you explain wilayat to our listeners?
Wilayat is, having authority upon us, which is, you know, this authority is given to Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So, over here, they had everything, right? But still, they chose to serve people.
So in a sense,
Imam Ali alayhi salam used to take loaves of bread on his shoulder and he used to roam around the streets of Kufa and feed children and feed orphans. If you really abide by these teachings, don't you think it's a betterment of society in that?
Except, it's for people in general.
Right.
Right? Being good, talking, I guess, in a sense, softly with one another. You're not screaming at each other's faces, right?
The norms we're talking about, that we have to, you know, follow these norms. We don't have to cross them. Like, what are the norms? Like, you know, what's haram? Drinking alcohol, that's haram. Adultery is haram.
Yeah.
It's connected to the society, right?
Exactly. Even if we look at the inner meanings of those, right? Drinking. Now, obviously, some religions say there's no issue. But if you really look at it, you're harming yourself while you're drinking.
Exactly.
Right? At the end of the day, Islam has prevented these things for a reason. There is an underlying reason behind all of these.
Like, right? Islam has stopped us from backbiting and all.
Exactly.
It's not just related to, like, ourselves, like, personally, right? It's about the development of society, the betterment of society.
Okay. So now you're saying these parameters that one should live by. When should you start doing this? When should you start applying this, say, not just for yourself, but suppose for your family as well? Say right now, suppose in the future, you're going to get married, you're going to have kids. When do you want to let them know about this? When do you want to, I guess, in a sense, where we say...
Are you talking about when should our young children know about this?
Exactly. When should we apply this concept to them?
look, now we should apply this concept. Like, we should teach them, you know, a few years before them getting baligh.
Before they reach the age of puberty.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, you should make them aware of this.
So don't, like, just throw the burden upon them. Slowly integrate it into their lives.
If you're asking about when should we apply these norms or when we should acquire this lifestyle, as I said before, there's no time where you're not acquiring this lifestyle. As I said before, Islam is not in our lifestyle, but our lifestyle is Islamic. That's all right. So it's nothing like, you know, acquiring it or leaving it.
So we live our life through the lens of Islam here.
Exactly. So when do you, apply this and teach our children? Before them getting baligh, before they're reaching to the age of puberty.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining me today,
my
brother
pleasure.
Hassanain. I will end the program here with a hadith from the Holy Prophet. He says, learning something during one's youth is like engraving in stone. And learning something when one is old is writing it on the surface of water, right? So with this hadith that we hear the Prophet telling us, that if you understand these parameters of Islam that we've just talked about in this session, understanding and applying these parameters towards our children, towards the youth, at a younger age, will solidify those practices within them. Compared to teaching someone who is older, who's already used to a lifestyle. It's just like writing on the surface of water. It'll be there for a second and it'll be gone the second the next wave comes by. Thank you for joining us today. And inshallah, we will see you in the next session.
Leaders visit to the IRGC Aerospace Force Exhibition. On Sunday, 19th of November, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, visited the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Aerospace Force Exhibition. The exhibition, entitled From Ideas to Products for a Strong Iran, was held at the Ashura University of Aerospace Science and Technology, and the latest cutting-edge products and technologies were put on public display. The exhibition included, inter alia, the latest drone technology, ballistic missile systems, defense systems, aerospace technology, and space technology. Commenting on the exhibition, Ayatollah Khamenei said progress will only be achieved if there is scientific innovation driven by hard work, determination and faith. He emphasized that innovation is absolutely necessary and is a fundamental principle of progress and development. The leader said his visit to the exhibition was delightful and necessary, and that he was very pleased to see the efforts made by young Iranian scientists and engineers and the advancement that has been achieved. In this program, we discuss the leaders' remarks and points of view expressed at this exhibition. Please stay with us. The Commander-in-Chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, visited the Ashura University of Aerospace Science and Technology on Sunday, 19th of November, to see the latest achievements of the IRGC Aerospace Force at its permanent exhibition. The exhibition, entitled From Ideas to Products for a Strong Iran, included missile, drone, defense, and space pavilions, also showcased the achievements of young scientists and engineers of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps Aerospace Force, and their innovative new products. The presence of the leader of the Islamic Revolution at the exhibition coincided with the unveiling of the Fatah II hypersonic cruise missile. Also unveiled where the Mehran mobile defense system, the upgraded Ninth of Day defense system, and the Shahed 147 drone. The Fatah II hypersonic maneuverable missile system is capable of posing a severe challenge to low, medium, and high altitude defense systems. The Shahed 147 unmanned aerial vehicle, or drone, is a wide-bodied aircraft with a wingspan of 26 meters. It can fly up to 60,000 feet, and its detection range can extend to more than 1,000 kilometers. For defense, the exhibition also displays systems that can intercept small flying objects and anti-aircraft missile systems that engage targets between the ranges of 20 and 320 kilometers. The latest innovations and advancements in ballistic rockets and satellite launching technology were also included in the exhibition. At the end of his visit, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the company of top IRGC commanders and officials of the Ashura University, described his visit as delightful and necessary. He also pointed out that its most significant feature was making correct needs assessment and applying science and research to solve various needs. He emphasized that scientific achievement is the result of innovation driven by hard work, determination, and faith. He said, "Whenever our young people committed themselves to something with determination and faith, they have been able to do great things." And the signs of determination and faith were clearly visible in this exhibition. The leader of the Islamic Revolution mentioned initiative and innovation as another feature of the Revolutionary Guard's aerospace program. He warned, "Of course, we should not be complacent, and the current level of success, when various military and civilian sectors worldwide are continuously active and achieving progress, we too must try to avoid falling behind." Ayatollah Khamenei called the technological advancement in branches of the armed forces rapid and vital, and emphasized that it was necessary not to lose momentum or to slow down. He said, "In some parts of the country, our situation is very good, but in others, our situation is not. There are shortages and deficiencies. In these areas, we must identify and actively answer the real needs." In another part of his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei spoke about the developments in occupied Palestine and the ongoing crimes being committed by the Zionist regime in the Gaza Strip. He said, "Events in Gaza have revealed many hidden truths to the people of the world, one of which is that leaders of Western countries are people who support racial discrimination." Ayatollah Khamenei called the Israeli regime the manifestation of racial discrimination itself and said, "The Zionists consider themselves as superior race and look down upon other human beings as inferior. This is why they could kill thousands of children without any pangs of conscience." He said, "When the President of the United States, the Chancellor of Germany, the President of France, and the Prime Minister of Britain, despite all their pretensions, support and help such a racist regime, it means that they too support racial discrimination, which is one of the most hateful practices in the world." Ayatollah Khamenei added, "The people of Europe and America should clarify what their duty should be in this situation and show that they do not support racial discrimination." Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that the Zionist regime has been a military and operational failure. He said, "Despite the massive bombing campaign in Gaza, the Israeli regime has so far failed in its efforts because, from the beginning, they said that their goal was to destroy Hamas and the resistance movement and grind them to dust. Now more than 40 days have passed, and despite using all of their military power, they still have not been able to achieve this objective. The leader of the Islamic Revolution described the barbaric bombing of hospitals and women and children in Gaza as a sign of how distraught the leaders of the Zionist regime are about their impending defeat. He poignantly added, "The defeat of the Zionist regime in Gaza is a reality. Advancing and entering hospitals or people's home is no victory, because victory means defeating the other side. This is something that the Zionist regime has not been able to achieve so far, and will not be able to do so in the future either." Ayatollah Khamenei said the Israeli regime itself could not comprehend the dimensions of this failure. He added, "The inability also characterizes America and the other Western powers. Now the whole world can see the reality that a regime well equipped with the most advanced weaponry has not been able to overcome its rival, who does not have any of this." Commenting on the obligations and performance of Muslim governments, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Some Islamic governments openly condemn the crimes being committed by the Zionists in Gaza. Some have not yet done so, and this is not acceptable. The main task is for Islamic governments to cut off the economic artery of the Zionist regime by preventing energy and goods from reaching this regime." The leader added, "Islamic governments should cut off their political relationships with the Zionist regime, at least for a limited time period." The leader added, "People of the world should not let the oppression of the Palestinian nation be forgotten, and they should continue to hold their rallies and demonstrations worldwide." In the end, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "We are sure of God's promise, we hope for the future, and we will do our duty." Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remembered the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears." Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Elam commemoration ceremony.
یکی از خصوصیات دیگر ایلام حضور همه جانبه همه قشرها بود تا از عالم برجسته فاضل اونجا مرحوم عاشق عبدالرحمن حیدری رحمت الله علیه که در میمکم با ما بود بنده اون بالا ایشونم در اون عاشق عبدالرحمن چند بار بنده آمدم چه قبل از ریاست جمهوری چه بعد از اون
Another characteristic of Elam was the wholehearted presence of people from all social backgrounds, from scholars to the common people. For instance, the late Sheikh Abdul Rahman Haydari, may God's mercy be upon him, was with me on the Maymak Hills. He was with me at the top of that summit. He was with me everywhere I went. I visited Elam several times, both before and after my presidency. He was always present in the field of battle as long as he was alive. He would take his gun and was ready to fight at all times in the true sense of the word. The same is true of the common people and the numerous tribes in Elam. Those who could fight were present in the field and the masses of the people helped in the resistance. One of the gentlemen in the meeting stated that the people did not leave the city. I myself saw this with my own eyes in the city of Elam. The enemy planes would regularly strike the city repeatedly. In those times, no one would remain on the streets and the people would go to one of the deserts or forests around the city. After the bombardment had finished, they would go back to the city. That is, this way of leaving and coming back to the city had become a routine activity for the people. But they never completely left the city or the province, and they stood firm.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
خب وقت در زیر همین بمباران هاست در همین شرایط سخت است که یک نخبه نابغه‌ای مثل شهید رضایی نژاد
It was during the time of those bombardments and in that difficult situation that a genius, namely Martyr Rezai Nejad, grew up. Martyr Rezai Nejad was a nuclear scientist who was martyred. His scientific importance was so immense that the enemy felt his existence would help the Islamic Republic progress, and so they assassinated him. They martyred him in front of his wife and small daughter. That young scientist had spent his youth witnessing those bombardments and those difficult circumstances in Elam.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me. You've done
in the limelight.
A pro-Palestine sit-in protest at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, earlier this month has sparked a slew of accusations of anti-Semitism and violence from a pro-Israel group, coupled with a concerted effort to permanently ban a student group. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, the Coalition Against Apartheid, CAA, at the center of organizing around ending the Zionist regime's occupation of Palestine, has become a target. But despite this campaign, in an already stifling climate around Palestine activism, with several universities banning pro-Palestine groups, students remain undeterred to continue their advocacy. Safiye Ogande, president of MIT's CAA, told Middle East Eye, there is a strong sense among the organizers within the CAA and within the broader coalition that we will be continuing to push forward and won't be swayed by any of these intimidation tactics that have been levied by the administration. I would honestly say that we are in a really strong position. On November 9th, MIT's CAA helped organize a protest on campus at Lobby 7, the main entrance to the campus. The plan was to stage a 12-hour peaceful sit-in protest. Nothing new for Lobby 7, which was the stage for a Black Lives Matter protest in 2019. The demonstrators planned to build on previous pro-Palestine actions over the past several weeks since the war on Gaza began, including a call for the university to end its MISTI Israel Lockheed Martin Seed Fund. The fund is an initiative that promotes an exchange between faculty and students at MIT and at universities and public research institutions in Israel, including at Lockheed Martin, an American defense contractor. However, the night before the protest was scheduled, organizers received notice that Lobby 7 was no longer a space that could be used to hold demonstrations on campus. Francesca Rico Ackerman, a PhD student at MIT, told Middle East Eye, if you're visiting MIT for the first time and you walk in the building, Lobby 7 is where you go. It's a very famous and historic place to hold protests. So for MIT the night before to send out communication saying, by the way, you're no longer allowed to protest in Lobby 7, and if you do, you're breaking MIT policy, was a shady move. Rico Ackerman said that the move to send the notice appeared to be intentionally trying to automatically cast anyone who participates in any kind of action as breaking institutional policy. Because of the last-minute nature of the notice, the demonstrators decided to continue on with the protest. In the first few hours of the protest, which began at 8 a.m., counter-protesters showed up, some with the Zionist regime's flags and posters, setting off a series of altercations between the two groups. Rico Ackerman, who had documented the protest throughout the day on X, shared videos of the demonstration showing counter-protesters putting posters in the face of students and one person physically breaking through a picket line. After 11 a.m., a leaflet was being passed around by the administration called on all demonstrators to leave Lobby 7 or be faced with suspension. Yet the protesters remained throughout the afternoon and evening, despite a lockdown of the area instituted by police later in the evening. One student who asked to remain anonymous told MEE, it was just such a beautiful show of solidarity to see so many people from all walks of life supporting Palestine. Likewise, Professor Nasser Rabat from the Department of Architecture at MIT told MEE that in the few hours he was present during the protest, he found the event to be peaceful, even cheerful. Since the events of November 9th, pro-Palestine protesters have been serially accused by pro-Israel students of having physically prevented Jewish and Israeli students from attending the class. Retsef Levy, a professor at MIT, also amplified their claim in a now-viral thread that also described Jewish students as remaining in their dorms in fear and over concerns. MIT was no longer safe for Jews. However, there is no evidence that shows any student, Jewish, Israeli, or otherwise, being physically blocked or hindered from attending class. Video evidence suggests that not only were pathways provided to students in Lobby 7 as the protest went on, but it was counter-protesters who had deliberately attempted to disrupt the rally inside the building. Footage shared with Middle East Eye, for instance, shows a counter-protester physically breaking the protesters' picket line when there appeared to be ample space for him to walk around the demonstrators. Another video showed a counter-protester breaking through a police line and shoving a pro-Palestine protester to the ground. In a private exchange on November 13th with the MIT Israel Alliance, later shared online by the group, MIT President Sally Kornblut said, "It's been falsely rumored that Jewish students were prevented from attending class. While we recognize a heightened sensitivity given the increase in reports of anti-Semitism around the country and in Greater Boston, we have received no evidence of any kind that Jewish students or anyone else were prevented from attending class." But then the next day, Kornblut said in a statement that there was a specific unease about passing through the Lobby 7, though it is not accurate that movement around the MIT campus is constrained. That statement, however, was later updated to say there were moments where some students were impeding access to Infinite Corridor and that, given the loud nature of the demonstration, it is no surprise that some students felt afraid of passing through Lobby 7. Levy, the professor who posted the viral thread, told MEE that this new statement from the MIT president confirmed that the reports of Jewish students being impeded from going to class are in fact true and consistent with the student letter 1. Posted on Twitter on November 10th, MIT would not comment on the contents of the letter to MITIA or what evidence had come to light a day later to warrant the new statement. Students present at the demonstration who spoke to MEE said they were growing increasingly frustrated with the lack of transparency at MIT and were appalled at the ongoing efforts by the administration to modify their statements to fit their narrative. In response to MEE's request for comment, MIT's media relations director, Kimberly Allen, said MIT leaders are working hard with the students, faculty, and staff to ensure everyone feels safe and able to focus on their classes, their research, and their work solving the world's toughest scientific problems. Meanwhile, Truthout, in another article, wrote, "Recently, in response to growing solidarity with Palestine, media giant Hearst censors its employees who publish posts in solidarity with Palestine. Media giant Hearst is instituting a new social media policy that bans its employees, including its journalists, from expressing personal political opinions online. Hearst is declaring that the channels for personal expression are company property, even when we are off the clock, Hearst magazine's media union said in a statement. Political posts such as personal views about political candidates or opinions about the Zionist regime's war on Gaza must first be reviewed by a supervisor before being posted on the staff's personal social media accounts. Staff who violate the rule are subject to discipline. The policy also encourages staff to report their co-workers for posts that they view as inflammatory. The policy, which was shared with the Washington Post, reads, "We should be careful to consider the impact that a controversial statement on a hot-button issue may have on Hearst's reputation." Meanwhile, Palestine Legal, a U.S.-based advocacy group that defends people who support Palestinian rights, believe that the implementation of this policy is in direct response to growing solidarity with Palestine. The group said on social media, "This is McCarthyism." In mid-October, Samir Onas, editor-in-chief of Hearst-owned Harper's Bazaar, was forced to apologize after posting an Instagram story where she called the Zionist regime's siege of Gaza the most inhuman thing she has ever seen in her life. Recently, Hearst magazine's media union shared the new policy on social media, urging members to not sign the restrictive policy while legal review is underway. The union filed an unfair labor practices complaint with the National Labor Relations Board, arguing that the policy should have been negotiated with the union first before going into effect.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A group of Italian journalists, representatives of media unions and organizations, gathered at the Roman Press Association in Rome to discuss how the ongoing conflict in the Gaza Strip has been biasedly covered by the media so far. The initiative was organized by the No Gag Network, a group that advocates for freedom of expression in Italy, as Palestinian and international journalists trapped in the coastal territory continue to be slaughtered by the Israeli occupation forces.
As of today, we don't know if these journalists have been executed or they have been killed in their homes together with their beloved ones during the Israeli bombardments. And I ask you, would that make any difference? It is horrific anyway.
During the meeting, journalists agreed that a war needs field reporting, condemning Israel's refusal to heed calls to allow independent reporters to access Gaza for direct testimony. Since October 9, the 2.3 million residents of Gaza have been experiencing a devastating near-complete communications blackout.
Killing a journalist is a war crime, and we call on the International Criminal Court to proceed with the examination into what's happening in Gaza.
The Italian journalists also relaunched a petition already signed by 200 French, Palestinian and Lebanese journalists demanding access to Gaza and the protection of journalists covering the Israeli onslaught on the Strip.
Freedom of expression has been buried under Gaza's rubble. Only journalists embedded with the IOF are in Gaza, operating under the observation of Israeli commanders in the field.
Speaking of freedom of expression, the future of journalism in Italy looks bleak. There has been a big question mark over the credibility of Italian media outlets in recent years as the sharp divide between the mainstream media and a large chunk of public opinion has been growing deeper. Meanwhile, Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has urged Israel to use the 4-day ceasefire in Gaza to carefully consider what the international perception is of its offensive against the Strip. Max Civili, Rome.
Marching towards Al-Quds, as they called it, over 5,000 members of Iran's Basij volunteer forces took to the streets downtown Tehran in one of the largest gatherings held in the Iranian capital to express their outrage at the ongoing Israeli bloodshed in Gaza and the deliberate targeting of children. Carrying the Palestinian flag, they chanted slogans against the occupying Israeli regime and its Western backers, the U.S. in particular, as they condemned the genocide in the besieged territory.
The besieged force is actually Iran's ordinary people, the ones who pray in mosques. So what you see here is the huge support of Iranians for men, women and children in Gaza.
My message to the kids in Gaza is that we will always support them.
More than 14,000 innocent Muslims have been killed so far. According to the statistics, nearly 7,000 of those who have been killed are children. As a member of the Basij volunteer force, I just had to take part in this rally. The oppressed people in Gaza should know that they are not alone.
Many demonstrators also carried bundled white shrouds symbolizing the children killed in Gaza in the Israeli attacks on schools and hospitals.
Everywhere in the world, people agree, and also according to international law, attacking hospitals is a war crime. As a member of the Basij force in the Faculty of Medicine, I'm here to condemn the war crimes committed by the Israeli regime.
Whenever in a war you see one side taking unconventional measures, it's a clear sign that they are desperate. Attacking women and children and killing children shows how weak the Israelis are. The people of Palestine should know that their victory is near.
We will always support the suppressed people of Palestine. All the people that you see here have come to condemn the Israeli regime. We will defend them till our last drop of blood.
The government's media office in Gaza announced on Thursday that at least 14,800 people have been killed in the Israeli attacks so far, including nearly 7,000 children, while over 36,000 have also been injured. 60% of the homes in Gaza have also been destroyed.
Since the beginning of the Israeli war on Gaza, not a day has gone by that Iranians have come out on the streets to show their support for the Palestinian people. More than 10 million people have so far signed up to go to Gaza. Yizumi Shah Ahmadi, Tehran.
In a heartwarming display of empathy and solidarity, thousands of school children from private and public schools across Pakistan gathered at a spirited children's rally to express their support for the Palestinian children facing the harsh realities of Israel's atrocities in Gaza. The event, marked by a sea of youthful faces, echoed with chants of unity and calls for justice.
Here to tell our Palestine sisters and brothers that they are not alone. We are always stand with them and we always raise our voice for them.
I'm here to support Palestine and support kids like me. My message is that the Palestinians shall be free.
Pakistani children, armed with compassion, stood united to condemn the injustices that Palestinian children face amid the ongoing war in Gaza.
We are here to show our support to the children of Palestine. We stand with them.
I am here to support the